Good morning to everybody. Hopefully everybody's wide and awake. Always takes me a little harder for me in the morning times. I tend to sleep in. Well, last time I spoke on the book of 1 Samuel. And I focused it on the theme of that book, which I thought to be pride. And in that sermon, I contrasted Saul, who was prideful, with David, who was shown to be humble. And David's humility and his faithfulness were emphasized throughout 1 Samuel. And in that book, he was made out to be this flawless figure. Today I'm going to focus on 2 Samuel. David is again a principal character in this book, and it covers his reign as king. And this book is written very historically. The events are really not interpreted very much by the author. And sometimes this causes you to kind of have some head-scratching moments about, well, is that what that person did really right? And I think of 2 Samuel as very comparable to the book of Judges. Both stories contain stories of God's chosen people, but both are filled with all kinds of questionable and sinful behavior throughout. So my goal today is to delve into the story of David's reign as king and to provide some interpretation to better understand this story. And the title of today's message is Understanding David and Understanding Sin. So one of the major differences between Judges and 2 Samuel is the level of detail that is given. So Judges spans 21 chapters over 400 years. And 2 Samuel, it spans 24 chapters over 40 years. And this gives 2 Samuel the unique ability to tell stories about a whole cast of characters that surround David. And many of these individuals are pretty complex, and it's kind of hard to interpret whether they're good or they're bad. Some of the advisors throughout this book are described as wise men, but when you look at their advice, it's pretty miserable. Jonadab's advice leads to Amnon raping his sister. Ahithophel's advice leads to Absalom having sex with all of David's concubines. And Hushai's sole purpose is to lead Absalom astray, to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. So these are the three advisors that are talked about in the book, the wise men. There's also many names throughout the book that you might remember, like Bathsheba, Michal, Abner, Abishai, Amasa, Absalom, and Mephibosheth. All of these have complex stories to them. And all of these, you may question, well, is this character a good or bad person? And the most complex character in this story is David's right-hand man, the leader of his army, Joab. So both books of Samuel have central stories in them that serve as key pivot points that hold the central lesson to the book. In 1 Samuel, that story is David and Goliath, a story of enormous faith, and a story of glory. But in 2 Samuel, that central story is David and Bathsheba, a story of horrific sin, a story of immense failure. These central stories couldn't be more opposite. And it's a testament to the different themes that are in these books. David had good qualities. He was humble. He was faithful. He had a zeal for God. He had a desire for righteousness. And all these especially stuck out before he was a king, but they remained as he was king, although he did have lapses in some of these at times. But David had two major flaws. And the first is somewhat obvious, and the second is not as obvious. You actually have to dig a little bit deeper into the story to actually see it. So let's go into the first flaw, which shows full force in the Bathsheba account. Let's start by turning to 2 Samuel 11, verse 2. We all know this story. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house, and the woman conceived. So she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." So from here, David's sins snowballs. He has Uriah come back from the battle that he was in, because he was one of the military men. And he's trying to get Uriah to sleep with his wife to kind of cover up his sin so that he doesn't know anything happened. But Uriah is too loyal. He just stays outside the palace. He never goes back to his home, doesn't do what David had kind of wanted him to do. So in the end, David has him kind of take back a message, which was really his own death warrant, to have him go out into the battle and get killed. It was a message to Joab. And that's exactly what happened. He died in battle. And Mike talked about this probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he posed the question, where did the murder occur? David never really hated Uriah, but he just wanted to cover up the sin. So it all began with that first sin. His desire over the regard for others, because he disregarded Uriah by sleeping with his wife. He disregarded Bathsheba by putting her in this awful position. Let's continue the story in 2 Samuel 12, verse 1. Then the Lord sent to David, and he came to him and said to him, "There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom. And it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to sin, who had come to him." So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord, God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes, and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all of Israel, before the sun." So David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord has put away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also who is born to you shall surely die." This is a really important part of this book. David was the king, so no one could really execute judgment against David except God himself. And here we see God execute judgment against David. And he judges with mercy. David deserved to die for his sins. But there were still consequences for this great sin. The sword will never depart from your house. Your wives will be given to your neighbor, and that neighbor will lie with them in the public view. And Bathsheba's child would die. All three of these came to pass. And David's legacy was tainted by this sin. The Messiah comes from the line of David, but there is an asterisk that comes with that. And we see that in Matthew as the lineage of Jesus is given. It says, "David the king begot Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. God did not forget Uriah. This name is in conjunction with David's in Jesus' line. So this sin was David's greatest failure. But what was his flaw that led to this? I think many believe that it would be beautiful women. And it's true in this case, he did fall prey to a beautiful woman, but there are no other accounts of adultery with David other than this. So I think this is a bit of an oversimplification of David's true flaw. The first hint of this flaw is when David mourns for Jonathan, back at the beginning of this book. So let's turn to 2 Samuel 1, verse 26. You might not think of this when you read it, because he's meaning it for something different, but 2 Samuel 1, verse 26. "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan." So this is right after he learns about Jonathan's death. "You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." So I get it. David is trying to communicate how much he loves Jonathan. And he states this by saying that his love for Jonathan surpassed the love of women. And the love between a man and a wife should be the greatest love that you can have in this physical life, that or one with your children. Those should be the greatest loves you have in this life. So that's what he's trying to get across with his love for Jonathan. But I also view this as a red flag. Because what does he mean by the love of women? Does he mean sex? Or is he talking about the love from the marriage relationship? If the love of women just means sex to him, then that's a problem. If friendship with Jonathan was better than his marriages, then that's also a problem. David had multiple wives already at this point, and we see this as being a problem throughout the Bible. We saw this in 1 Samuel with Hannah. It was a problem for her. A marriage is intended to be a lifelong relationship between one man and one woman. And when it's manipulated to be something different than that, that strong bond of love, that strong bond of trust is lost. David's marriages and his family life is certainly broken down after the Bathsheba incident, but we can actually see the breakdown kind of occurring even before then. Even before he had that incident. So again, what was his big flaw? Let's turn next to 2 Samuel 3, verse 13. And David said, and he's talking to Abner here, "Good, I will make a covenant with you." Now Abner was the military commander of Ishbosheth's army. So at this time he's in a civil war with Ishbosheth, and he's trying to kind of make a peace. "Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I will require of you. You shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And then Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Then her husband went with her to Baharum, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, "Go, return," and he returned. So this is a really bad situation. And it's a situation really created by Michal's father, Saul, because he used Michal to fulfill a promise he made, a promise that he intended to kill David with, to get these foreskins from the Philistines. And then after this, once David had earned her, he ended up giving her to another man. So David had every right to get her back if he still loved her. But love is not a part of his argument here. His argument is he paid for her with 100 foreskins. And it gets to the root of the problem that David had with women. He viewed them as property. He viewed them as pretty objects. He viewed them as trophies. And we see this with Bathsheba, and we see this with Michal. Now let's turn to 2 Samuel 6, verse 20. So David had been... This is the bringing back of the ark, and David was dancing around, and Michal has a bit of bitterness to David, and we kind of see this coming out when David comes back from that. "Then David returned to bless his household, And Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler of the people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord, and I will be even more undignified than this, and will be humble in my own sight. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. So this story shows a bitterness that is between David and his wife, Michal. David's zeal for God was not wrong, but his response to this criticism comes off as very cold and unloving. And it begs the question, why did David really want her back? And you kind of get the answer here. The Lord chose me instead of your father. It all goes back to who her father was. He was the preceding king. He viewed this marriage as legitimizing his right to the throne, at least in the eyes of the people. She was a trophy. It was a marriage to solidify the throne, which was a real problem throughout monarchies throughout time. And it plays out here with David's marriage with Michal. But he didn't get the throne because he was married to Saul's daughter. He got the throne because God had anointed him to have the throne. Now let's turn to 2 Samuel 15, verse 16. This is during Absalom's rebellion and David's leaving. 2 Samuel 15, verse 16. He's leaving Jerusalem. "Then the king went out with all his household after him, but the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep the house." So David is fleeing because his son is after his life. And what does David do? He leaves his concubines, essentially his wives, to keep the house. Again, he's not thinking of these women as people. He's thinking of them as property. And this stupid decision puts these women in a terrible situation that leads to scandal with them and Absalom. Our society is different than Israel in that it allows women to be more independent. But there is still a sexualization of women where they are viewed as pretty objects and trophies. And their whole industry is designed to make men lust after women and to make women try to generate that lust. This is just another way that women are made to be objects. And it leads to problems, it leads to sin. And David is a prime example of how objectifying women produces bad results. And it's probably his greatest flaw. His second flaw is less apparent, but you see it if you read his story closely. David is often made out to be the greatest king of Israel. But in 2 Samuel, it becomes clear that the people didn't necessarily think of him as a great or rightful king. Because After all, there were three revolutions during his reign. And that's not what you would expect from a beloved ruler. And much of that has to do with the second flaw. And the author doesn't state it, but the characters in the story seem very aware of it. So let's turn to 2 Samuel 15, verse 2. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such, a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me. Then I would give him justice." And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So this is Absalom's way of winning the hearts of the people. And to me, it seems very shallow. But at the same time, it's hard to ignore the effectiveness of it. And I think Absalom's actions here are in direct response to David's second flaw. Just like political opponents today, Absalom was going after David's Achilles heel. And what was Absalom doing? He was positioning himself as judge, a good judge, a judge that was better than his father. And it doesn't seem really hard to convince the people of this, because by all accounts, David was a miserable, miserable judge. And no doubt Absalom knew this. He heard the people groaning about David's poor judgment. And we can see a little bit of this even in the introduction of 2 Samuel, where Amalekite comes with a message that Saul and Jonathan had died. And he gives an account of the story of what had happened. Saul is dying on the battlefield. And he begs him to kill him. And it makes sense, because the Philistines would have tortured him. And it's pretty clear that they would have tortured him by what they did with his body after he was already dead. So the foreigner kills Saul at Saul's command, brings the crown to David. And in the story, there's no indication of any hatred towards Saul. He was an Amalekite, so he would have had reason to hate Saul. So he could have hated him, but the story doesn't make it play out that way. And there was no indication that he was necessarily going to get a reward for killing Saul. Now, he might have thought that he might get a reward for bringing back the crown, but no indication of getting a reward for killing Saul. But David executed him anyways, because he said he killed the Lord's anointed. And he ignores the details of the story that the Lord's anointed had requested this. So this particular example, you may not be convinced, but to me it seems like bad judgment. It seems like he killed an innocent subject who was actually on his side. Now let's turn to 2 Samuel 3, verse 24. This is again a story of the civil war between David and Ishbosheth, who was Saul's son. And David had made peace with Abner, Saul's and Ishbosheth's commander, who had a lot of political clout. And this peace gives a huge advantage to David in this civil war. But not everybody on David's side saw it that way. So 2 Samuel 3, verse 22. Then Joab came to the king and said, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he has already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing." And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sarah. But David did not know it. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach, so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard it, he said, "My kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or is a leper, who leans on a staff or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. So Joab had sought vengeance over his brother's death. Abner had killed him in battle. And Joab murders Abner. It's hard to view this action, what he did to Abner, as anything other than murder. Abner had just made peace with David. So this is a huge stain on David's reputation. David recognized this, and he basically says, "It wasn't me." He pronounces a curse on Joab and his family, but that's it. In 2 Samuel 8, verse 16, you don't have to turn there, it says, "Joab, the son of Uriah, was over the army." So he named him the commander after this. Was this justice? No. And I think the people would have felt the same way. David was not good at enforcing consequences when people that were close to him did awful things. Joab and David's relationship, it's complicated throughout his reign. Joab was David's cousin, and he was the military leader of Israel for the majority of his reign. Joab often undermined the authority of David, and he got away with it every time. David consistently allowed it with no consequences. During the civil war with Absalom, David commanded the army to deal gently with Absalom in the hearing of all the army, and Joab was there. But when Absalom gets stuck in a tree, a position where he could have easily been captured, Joab killed him instead. And David grieves for his son after this. And instead of David doing anything to Joab, Joab scolds David. Let's read this in 2 Samuel 19, verse 5. "Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, 'Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemy and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived, and all of us had died, then it would have pleased you well. Now therefore, arise, go out, and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told all the people, saying, "There is the king sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king. So it seems odd that David would have allowed this. But Joab, he was on to something, because in the very next chapter, Israel did revolt against him. And David, this time, did try to impose some level of consequence on Joab. It says, and if we drop down to verse 13, it says, "And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab." So Amasa was the commander of the army of Absalom. So now he has placed Amasa as the new commander and has demoted Joab. That's his consequence for Joab. But how does this go? Let's turn to 2 Samuel 20, verse 4. "And the king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself." This is the next revolution that had occurred. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." So Joab's men, with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men, went out after him. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at its hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. And so Joab strikes again. Surely David will do something against Joab this time. Let's read verse 23. "And Joab was over all the army of Israel. Benai, the son of Jehoadai, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites." Nope. He just promotes Joab to lead the army again. It's baffling to me. No justice and no consequences. Another case of David's bad judgment is with Amnon and his daughter Tamar. Amnon makes this weird request to have his sister feed him while he's sick. And David thinks nothing of this request. And in the process of this, Amnon rapes Tamar. And Amnon deals with her awfully. He ends up hating her and tells her to go away. And David's response to this whole situation is, "But when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry." There's no indication of any consequences towards Amnon, at least from David. Absalom, the full brother of Tamar, has a different idea. He's waiting for the right moment, and he ends up murdering Amnon. Just triggers an event triggers the snowball of events that eventually leads to Absalom's revolution. Again, there's no justice, no consequences, and it leads to lots and lots of problems for David. We also see that David is sometimes easily swayed in his judgments. He's believing the person who's speaking to him at the time. And this is a common human flaw. We tend to sympathize with those who are complaining to us rather than being skeptics of what they're saying. And this happens in the case of Ziba and Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was the crippled son of Jonathan. David took care of him because he was honoring his good friend Jonathan, and Mephibosheth even ate at David's table. Ziba was Mephibosheth's lead servant. And during Absalom's rebellion, Ziba comes with a bunch of food to help feed David's army. And David says, "Where is Mephibosheth?" And Ziba says, "Mephibosheth stayed to reclaim the throne for his father's house." Seems like a questionable story as a reader, but David believes it. And Ziba is given ownership rights to all of Mephibosheth's possessions. And after the war and David returns, Mephibosheth comes out to greet David. Let's turn to 2 Samuel 20, verse 24. Now, Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king,' because your servant is lame." And he slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, 'You and Ziba divide the land.'" Then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." So someone is lying in these two stories because they both contradict each other. And Mephibosheth, to me, seems more believable. It just seems odd that a cripple would try to take the throne. It seems odd that he would just leave his appearance just kind of deteriorate after David left if he's trying to take the throne. Doesn't seem like somebody who's trying to rise to power. And David really doesn't drill down any further into who is telling the truth at all. He says, "It's too complicated. Split it." Another example of David's inability to judge effectively. And is it easy to see why Israel might have been frustrated with David? It's also easy to see why Solomon might have asked for wisdom to judge his people. He saw this flaw in his father. The purpose of this message is to better understand David. And as we dig deeper and understand biblical stories such as these, there are lessons that pop up that we can apply. And I have three takeaways from this story in 2 Samuel. First is people should not be treated as objects. People should not be treated as objects. David fell into this trap with women on multiple occasions. Bathsheba was the object of his desire. Michal was the trophy that justified his kingship. And the concubines, they kept house. It's sad that that's what it really amounted to David. But there may be a cultural aspect to this, but it doesn't excuse the sin. The same can be said about slave owners throughout time who treated humans as property. Our culture is not completely detached from this mindset. The advertisement industry objectifies women to sell their products. It doesn't matter whether someone's a different gender, ideology, class, race, age, or even a stranger that you're never going to see again. We should treat them all as human beings, not as objects. To allow culture or anything else to do differently leads to sin. Key takeaway number two, sin has to have consequences. Sin has to have consequences. David seems to have shown mercy a lot, just like our merciful Father. But he went too far, because oftentimes David didn't have any consequences, and sin has to have consequences. We can look at the opening story with Bathsheba. God had mercy on David. He didn't kill him. David deserved death. He committed adultery. He murdered. Both of these were death penalty crimes in Israel. But that mercy God showed didn't mean there weren't consequences. David suffered from the consequences throughout the rest of his life of that action. Law is there for a reason. It promotes peace. When law is broken and there are no consequences, there is no peace. Now, there are limits to us in how we can impose such consequences. We are not judges. We aren't politicians, and even if we were, there are cases where God's law and America's law just don't align. We can merely uphold and promote God's law as much as we possibly can. And we can try to change our spheres of influence. We can try to change how we operate within our homes, how we operate with our children. We should try to be like God. We should try to have a heart of mercy, but there still has to be consequences. It's not easy always to do, but it's necessary. Key takeaway number three, understand and overcome our flaws. Understand and overcome our flaws. No one is without flaws. David had many good qualities, but his flaws dominated his later life. And he never seemed to overcome those flaws. And at the end of his life, we see that he has regrets. He advises King Solomon to judge the likes of Joab and he and other people that he had been too merciful to, at least in his mind, over the course of his life. In Stephen's sermon last week, he talked about the importance of evaluating ourselves for Passover. We're to understand the areas where we are susceptible and weak. We need to try to strengthen and mitigate those weaknesses. Often our greatest strengths is our greatest weakness, and vice versa. One of my great strengths is I'm a logical person. It really helps me as being a software engineer to really like logic and be able to operate within code using logic. And from a spiritual perspective, this attribute can help me study the Bible. I love trying to find the different connections within the Bible. But it can be a challenge for me with prayer, being a logical person, because prayer is an emotional activity. It's an area that I need to work on. It's an area that I've probably always needed to work on. Understanding ourselves, our weaknesses, are critical to our spiritual progress. David was an incredible person, but he was still human. In reading 2 Samuel, his weaknesses really showed through. He was not good with women. He viewed them as objects, and he viewed them as property, and this led to problems. He was not a good judge. His inability to provide justice caused problems that just snowballed into catastrophe and revolution. These two flaws were at the crux of David's seemingly endless problems throughout his reign as king. And if he could have overcome these flaws, he would have saved himself so much heartache. We should learn from David. People should not be treated as objects. Sin has to have consequences. We should understand and overcome our flaws. These are three key takeaways from this story that we can use as we prepare for Passover.